Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-3028 et al. Enri Tony Lewis, petitioner. Mr. Kirsch for the petitioner, Mr. Smith for the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, Stephen Kirsch on behalf of the petitioner, Tony Lewis. What Mr. Lewis is seeking is simply the opportunity for a United States District Court judge to hear him and to hear arguments on his claim that he's entitled to a reduction in his sentence for extraordinary efforts at post-sentencing rehabilitation. And those efforts would be compared to other similarly situated inmates. Just historically now, Mr. Lewis has been serving a sentence for 20 years. He received his first life sentence in 1989 following a trial in the United States District Court. In 1992, a joint eight-defendant motion for motion to vacate sentence was filed, and it was filed commonly on behalf of all eight men who were convicted at the trial court. That motion to vacate was denied by the trial judge, and it was appealed to this court. And in 1996, this court affirmed both the conviction and the denial of the motion for a new trial, motion to vacate. That is what the government says constitutes Mr. Lewis's first habeas petition under 2255. Excuse me. In 1997, Mr. Lewis filed his first pro se petition seeking to vacate his sentence and raise certain grounds. Mr. Nesbitt, his trial counsel, in 1998 filed the first supplement to Mr. Lewis's pro se petition. In Mr. Nesbitt's supplement to the 1997 petition, he specifically sets out that he had lost contact with Mr. Lewis. And Mr. Nesbitt asked the court to appoint him as his counsel for purposes of proceeding with the second successive petition. Mr. Nesbitt had been retained to represent Mr. Lewis at the trial. After the trial, when the first joint motion was filed, Mr. Nesbitt, there's a signature line for him, and above it is an S, but it's signed off by another attorney, Elise Haldane. So what the record evidence shows is that Mr. Nesbitt did not sign off on the first petition, which was filed back in 1992, and in 1998, when Mr. Nesbitt came back into the picture, he says to the court, I've lost contact and I'm asking that I be appointed. So in this interim period, and this is the period of time when Mr. Lewis filed his pro se motion, Mr. Nesbitt's not in the picture. So our argument is that we should be granted leave to proceed on the second successive petition because we do satisfy the McKenzie versus Zant standards, which is pre-EDPA, which was enacted in 1996, of cause and prejudice. The cause that we have is that Mr. Lewis was not in any way involved in the preparation of the first motion to vacate the sentence. He had absolutely no involvement. It wasn't sent to him for review. His ideas were not solicited by Mr. Nesbitt, and it appears from the pleading, and as we all know, Mr. Nesbitt is deceased, but it appears from the pleading that Mr. Nesbitt did not engage himself in the drafting of that document. And the document speaks very generally.
You said it was signed by counsel for one of the other defendants?
That's correct.
And were they in the same partnership, the two lawyers?
They were not in the same partnership. They couldn't have been because they were co-defendants. I believe that Mr. Nesbitt and Ms. Haldane shared office space, but they were not, there wasn't a formal partnership. But so Mr. Lewis, who at that time was serving a sentence in California, is stuck with this pleading that doesn't say anything about him. The pleading raised fifth.
Well, I mean, serving a sentence is inherent in the nature of the case.
That's true.
And where it is, it seems to me immaterial. BOP sends people around all over the place.
That's true. There's nothing to suggest that there was ongoing contact. And what the record suggests is that there was not.
At some time of several years later, there was not.
That's correct. But that pleading that was filed in 1992, it just very commonly raised Fifth and Sixth Amendment issues and Brady issues. There's not a word in there that's specific to Tony Lewis or raises any of his claims.
What about the government's argument, as I understand it, that you can't establish prejudice in any event because this kind of claim is not cognizable under 2255? Can you address that?
Our position is that it is cognizable under 2255, and we start with United States versus Rhodes from this court. And this court specifically said that post-sentence rehabilitation is a matter that can be raised and can be addressed by the trial court. Now, I acknowledge that in Rhodes, that was a resentencing. And that
2255, right?
Exactly. And that person was fortunate to come back on resentencing, so he was able to raise his claims. What I rely upon is that, number one, in Rhodes, it was a resentencing, but the court did not say this is limited to resentencing issues. It just happened to be a resentencing. But we rely upon Williams versus Lockhart from the Eighth Circuit, which was a very similar case to this factually. And in Williams versus Lockhart, the Eighth Circuit said that they would recognize a second or successive petition, and they remanded the case back down to the trial court for the trial judge to make factual findings as to whether or not the petitioner participated in the preparation of the first 2255.
Maybe I didn't understand, Judge Kavanaugh. Is that responsive to your question, Judge?
Somewhat.
All right. I guess then I will follow up with a question. What makes you think that relief based upon post-conviction rehabilitation is cognizable within 2255, not Lockhart?
Well, the case I'm relying upon is Williams versus Lockhart.
Lockhart, a post-conviction rehabilitation case?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's the Eighth Circuit. It's a 1988 case. And in there, they had the same situation where the petitioner was saying that he did not participate in the filing of the first one.
I thought it was for the latter point that you were relying on Lockhart, that a second petition may be deemed a first petition under certain circumstances. But you say it's also authority for the circumstance, for relief from post-conviction.
I believe it is.
Based on post-conviction.
I believe that's what it was cited
rehabilitation.
So Mr. Lewis has been trying to be heard for 12 years. He filed his pro se motion in 1997. Then Mr. Nesbitt filed the first supplement. Then after Mr. Nesbitt died, I entered my appearance and I filed the second supplement. And we've been waiting to be heard to have this issue addressed.
So is your argument that Mr. Lewis was in fact ignorant of that first filing, or that counsel was ineffective?
Both. That counsel had duty to have Mr. Lewis participate in the preparation of the motion to vacate, that counsel had a duty to inform Mr. Lewis of, at that time, what was known as the abuse of the writ standard, but to let him know that if we go ahead and file this, and then you want to file something later on, there's going to be a procedural bar to your being able to litigate that issue. He was not informed of those factors.
Mr. Kirsch, do you have Lockhart with you?
No, I have the citation to it.
All right, why don't I give you this? Are you going to preserve your rebuttal time?
Yes, I am.
All right, why don't you take this copy of Lockhart and show me it in your rebuttal how it deals in any way with 2255 being applicable to rehabilitation.
Very well.
Thank you.
And I'll preserve the remainder of my argument.
May it please the Court, Peter Smith on behalf of the United States.
Mr. Smith, let me ask you to begin where we left off. Is the relief that's being requested here cognizable in 2255?
We think not, Your Honor.
If you're correct on that, do we need to say anything more? Do we need to create a split with the Eighth Circuit in order to satisfy your preferences of the day? Or can we just let you prevail on the ground that there's no... the 2255 doesn't reach this?
I think that we could prevail on the latter point. There are no cases that I'm aware of, and there's no legal authority I'm aware of that prohibits the court from addressing that question, and that certainly is an economical and efficient way for the court to dispose of the appeal. Of course,
Okay, well then, go ahead.
I was going to say, of course, that sidesteps the cause and prejudice analysis, which was addressed by our opponent. And I would also like to address...
Yes, it sidesteps making law on the subject that if we needn't do so, right?
That's correct.
Right. Now, why isn't 2255 sufficient to raise this claim?
Well, there are at least three reasons, Your Honor.
Putting aside whether it's a second or successive petition, in other words.
Correct, I understand. First of all, the text of 2255 does not allow a freestanding claim of post-sentencing rehabilitation.
Where is that text in your brief?
The text, Your Honor, is found, among other places, in the statutes and regulations in the very beginning portion of the brief, immediately following the references.
Is there a page number?
It's page Roman page 5.
Okay, got it.
28 U.S.C. 2255A mm-hmm. is at present the citation I'm referring to, and it says, among other things, that the jurisdiction of the district court to resolve a motion under 2255 is limited to cases in which the court was without jurisdiction to impose a sentence, the sentence was in excess of the maximum authorized by law, or is otherwise subject to collateral attack. And
so if this is cognizable, it's because it's otherwise subject to collateral attack.
That's the only basis one would be able to argue that, Your Honor, but that's foreclosed by the Supreme Court's decision in Ad Inizio, which is cited in the government's brief. In that case, the Supreme Court held that the defendant's claim that he was entitled to a parole or a probation decision that would reduce his sentence wasn't cognizable under 2255, and that has been widely interpreted by courts for the broader proposition that this sort of post-sentencing rehabilitation claim can't go forward. There's a footnote in the government's brief where we cite numerous district court cases. As I mentioned, Ad Inizio has taken on that meaning in the law. And the last reason that I would say that...
There's no case that goes the other way, correct?
That's correct. And the last thing that I would mention in terms of the claim not being cognizable under 2255 is that appellant's only case citation, and I think the court will discuss with him Lockhart, and I will address that in a moment, but the case he relies upon in his briefs is Rhodes. And Rhodes is a very specialized case. There was a remand for resentencing, and there the district court already has jurisdiction to resentence the defendant. So you're there on another hook. You're there on a resentencing hook. Rhodes does not stand for the proposition that somebody can simply petition the district court under 2255 with no other claim of constitutional violation and no other jurisdictional basis to be in the district court and say, district court, I'm entitled to relief because of my post-conviction behavior while I've been incarcerated. Rhodes certainly doesn't stand for that proposition. And as we pointed out in our brief, it's not even clear Rhodes still controls because of this question about...
You don't need that anyway.
It's
just not 2255.
That's correct. Those cases are about resentencing. We don't really quibble with appellant petitioner's point that there are cases that exist that say that upon a resentencing, a court can consider those factors. Of course, the amended guidelines say that you can't consider that, but there are cases like Rhodes that say the district court can, but those are limited to resentencing. So appellant hasn't raised any argument in the context of this appeal that his claim, the only one he's currently advancing, is cognizable under 2255.
If it were cognizable, I suppose we'd have a lot of petitions.
We would. I think that's one of the points we made in our brief. I mean, and again, that's what I was saying before about how Ad Inizio has been interpreted by courts in order to forestall that flood of pleas for leniency. And there are a number of cases going way back that talk about pleas for leniency not being the appropriate subject of a habeas petition, and we did not cite those cases in our brief, and I'm not addressing any specific case, but that's a proposition of law that's existed for quite some time.
On the question of whether the successive petition should be permitted. Do you think it makes any difference whether Mr. Lewis is claiming that he was totally ignorant of that first petition or claiming that his counsel was ineffective?
I think that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Six of the U.S. Courts of Appeals against the two cases cited by petitioner have held that since a defendant doesn't have a right to counsel for the first 2255 petition, that alleging ineffective assistance of counsel, whether that's I wasn't consulted adequately or I didn't even know about the filing of my petition, where the person is represented doesn't matter because he's not entitled to representation. And those cases are cited in the government's brief. The two cases that go the other way, Lockhart was referenced earlier, and I'll discuss that case in a moment. But one of the cases cited by Appellant Deutscher actually supports the government's view because in that case, in both cases, Lockhart and Deutscher show or recognize that there is a presumption if someone is represented that they are in contact with their counsel and that whatever is filed by counsel is part of that representation. And to overcome that presumption, there is a burden upon, in this case, petitioner. And we argue in our brief at length that he hasn't met that burden. He hasn't given the court anything, the district court, anything in terms of an affidavit or even a proffer for that matter. All he's done is make an assertion in his brief that he was unaware of the filing of his petition. So that gets him at, for example, Deutscher came out the other way, and it's cited by petitioner, but it actually supports the government's position because there the defendant came up with an affidavit from his own counsel where counsel admitted that he hadn't consulted with the defendant in that case. So that's consistent with the government's position. The only one that's not is Lockhart, and Lockhart is wrongly decided because Lockhart goes on at length to explain that there is this presumption. But then it remands to find out whether the defendant in that case could conceivably overcome this presumption. And we think that's simply the wrong outcome because the defendant's already in the district court. He can file an affidavit. He had that opportunity, and he didn't do that. There's no need in that case to remand. So as I've mentioned, seven, because we're counting Deutscher as supporting the government, seven of the courts of appeals support the government's position. Only one has come out on the other side of that question. The only cause that petitioner has identified is the fact that he didn't have any substantive input, according to him. And again, that's unsupported. And that claim came very late in the day. But that is his only claim on cause, as far as I can tell. He also argues I suppose a related point that his attorney at the time, Leroy Nesbitt, wasn't engaged in the drafting of the motion. And again, as I mentioned in response to Judge Brown's question, six of the courts of appeals have made clear that that's not something that would be counted in the calculus. There's no question in this case that petitioner was represented by Mr. Nesbitt. And I would note that the government's appendix contains, among other things, the docket for this case, and Mr. Nesbitt filed a notice of appeal, noted an appeal of the denial of the 2255 petition by the district court and wasn't involved in the briefing of the case. The direct appeal and the 2255 petition were consolidated for purposes of appeal by this court way back in 1993, and that was briefed. And appellant's claim now, and again, this is a claim that's essentially made for the first time on appeal, is that because Elise Haldane signed on behalf of Mr. Nesbitt that the first 2255 petition shouldn't count. Again, the majority of the courts of appeals have rejected that kind of an argument, and even if one disagreed with those courts, petitioner hasn't made any kind of factual showing that would support his factual claims on appeal, and he certainly can't overcome the very high cause and prejudice requirements that he would need to meet. He had an opportunity to prove up his claim in the district court, and he did not do that, and he's made these claims, many of which are made for the first time on appeal.
Anything further?
there are no further questions, we urge the court to deny the mandamus petition and to deny the alternative request to file a successive motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Kirsch? Does Lockhart bear upon your nature of the claim?
I think it does. I think Lockhart was a 2255 case, and it was filed as a 2255.
Yes, my question was whether it brings within 2255 a claim for relief based on post-conviction rehabilitation.
I believe that it does. I thought
it enumerated nine claims, and that was not among them.
It enumerated nine claims, but they said they were not new claims, and that's why they were rejected. It's found that seven of the new grounds constituted abuse of the writ because they concern matters known by Williams at the time his first petition was filed. So they're saying that they rejected those claims not because it wasn't 2255, but they rejected those claims because it was something that he would have known or should have known about when he filed his first 2255 petition. That's how I would read it. I think.
But there isn't anything in it about rehabilitation.
No, because that wasn't the issue in Lockhart.
That's my point. So Lockhart stands only for your other point that if he's totally ignorant of the filing, it doesn't count against him.
Yeah, that's correct.
Not for the point that 2255 is a viable medium for the relief he's seeking.
I would agree with that. Okay. I would agree with that.
What do you have on that issue?
We don't have anything on that issue.
Just new.
It's not been decided by this court, but it's the only way that someone could take advantage of Rhodes absent a resentencing hearing is to come back in on a 2255.
Right. If there is a way, that would be.
If that would be the only way to do it. But if I could just respond to a couple of things. The government says, well, Mr. Lewis never raised this in the trial court. But I have in pleading that was filed on December 2nd, 1999, and this was an opposition to the motion to transfer. It says, this is at page 6 of the appendix, which is exhibit number 6, page 6. It says, the initial 2255 motion was filed on behalf of defendant and eight other co-defendants. Defendant was unable to argue his individual claims fully, and additional claims have emerged subsequent to the initial motion. So 10 years ago, the government was on notice that Mr. Lewis was in fact alleging that he did not participate in his initial 2255 motion. And I would also like to respond to the government's argument on Deutscher. Deutscher does stand for the proposition that we've cited it for. And the record satisfies us that the district court properly found that Deutscher did not understand the significance of federal habeas proceedings and did not authorize Alsui to file the federal habeas petition. So Deutscher, we submit, of the two circuit cases that go our way, we submit is in fact right on point in the fact that they're looking to, did this person have any knowledge about the filing of the first petition? If they didn't have knowledge, it shouldn't count. So for those reasons, we would ask for the relief request.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
I know you were appointed by the court to represent Mr. Lewis in this matter, and we're very grateful for your assistance.
You're welcome. Thank you.